This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. There's a lot that can be done to rework, reinterpret, and reimagine the music by 17th century composer and organist Johann Sebastian Bach. Here's a montage featuring some contemporary musicians.
Many's the time I've been mistaken, and many times confused. Yes, and I've often felt forsaken, and certainly misused. Oh, but I'm all right, I'm all right.
You just heard Jethro Tull's Barret in E minor, followed by Apollo 100's Joy, then Paul Simon's American Tune, inspired by St. Matthew Passion Chorale, and resolving with Everything's Gonna Be All Right by Sweetbox, updating Bach's Air on a G-string. Our guest, Paul Eli, has written a book, Reinventing Bach, about the influence Bach has had on musicians and composers who discovered his work long after he had died. He credits Bach's genius as a composer and the evolution and development of technology in the last century, from the wax cylinder to the compact disc to the MP3. Paul Eli is a faculty member at Georgetown University, a longtime editor at Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Paul Eli, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Help us understand your love for Bach, which comes through in your book.
Well, my love for Bach comes from the radio. Every Christmas, WKCR, the Columbia University radio station, after playing jazz most of the year, it turns over the airwaves to the music of Bach for a week or 10 days every Christmas. And one year, I was listening to jazz and left the radio on, and there was the music of Bach. And I heard it. Of course, I'd heard some Bach before, but to hear Bach all day long and then go to bed and wake up and it's still there, by that next morning, I had totally fallen for Bach. And the experience of being able to hear the work over and over for a few days without having to make the decisions as a consumer as to what record I should buy next and which performer enabled me to just fall deep and hard for the music of Bach, and I'm still feeling that way.
But what do you think is it about his music that has allowed it to not just survive to the 21st century, but to be, as you write in your book, reworked, reimagined, reorchestrated? What is it about how Bach approached composing, you think, that has inspired so many people?
His music is paradoxical. It's got the best of both worlds musically, let's say. It's phenomenally express. It sounds very personal and yet not autobiographical. It's worked out in a way that a piece that's by Bach, it's hard to think that it's by anybody else, and yet it's open to adaptation on different instruments, in different contexts. You can play it with a small orchestra or a large one. You can be Jethro Tull working it out for flute and guitar, or do it by the letter as it was done in 1710. I think people would say Bach did the music of joy better than anybody else, and yet it's never saccharine. Mm. He knows death. He knows the dark side of life, and there's great vigor to even his simplest pieces, the ones that kids learn to play.
And do you think the fact that he was an organist, I mean, he played other instruments as well, but he was an organist, also helps us to understand his music And as you also say, he was an inventor in his own right.
Well, the organ was the most complex piece of machinery that most people of his time encountered. It was either an organ or a ship. And so we don't think of Bach as a techie, but that's what he was. You had to know how the organ worked. You had to know how to put it together when it came apart. You had to know how to remake it to your own specifications. So he was a very technical musician. And at that time, the organ was seen as the instrument of instruments. The organ could do all the things that other instruments could do and then some. And that, I think, explains just how comprehensive Bach's musical achievement is. He was the master of the instrument of them all for his period.
You write a lot about Glenn Gould in this book, and I do want to play a recording. This is a 1955 recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations No. 5. But before we listen to that, why is it important to hear Glenn Gould playing Bach?
Well, Glenn Gould is the musician in whose hands Bach really became modern. The way I think about it, we're used to thinking of the composer back there and then the performers far removed from the composer. And then we don't think about the recordings as writers outside of the shop or outside of our home. So what I try to do in the book is put it all together. All these musicians are really all playing on the Bach team. And so Gould is the one who assimilated so much of the music that had gone before him because he could listen to records and then make a record that 60 years later still has the sparkle of a new work for us.
Let's listen again to Glenn Gould's 1955 recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations No. 5. You write in your book, what did Gould seek in Bach? What do you think he sought in Bach? That's quite an extraordinary performance, we should just say.
Right. Talk about 36 seconds of real musical intensity.
Exactly.
We just heard it.
And precision, of course.
In Bach, he sought a musician who, like himself, made use of technology to make his music more human. For Gould, the recording studio was not an impersonal place, a way to a sterile environment where he could make music perfectly. It was a place where he could discover Bach. He would play the pieces over and over, not to get them perfect, but to find something in them that would surprise even himself. And I think we can hear some of that sense of discovery in the performance that you just played.
In fact, he in his career gave up performing out in public and really preferred the recording studio.
He did, but it's usually thought that that was that he's a hermit and that he withdrew. This was the place where he felt most human and most fully alive, and it was also really practical. In 25 years in the recording studio, he made dozens of recordings, and it's now clear in retrospect, because he died at 50, that if he hadn't taken all that time in the studio, we wouldn't have all that music of his.
And made classical music recordings quite popular.
That's right. He had a sense of what sounded good on record, as opposed to what sounded good in the concert hall, and then he would do it over again the next day in the recording studio. This was the place for him. We're sitting in a recording studio now, and this is where he made his music.
Let me play something that would be familiar to Philadelphians. This is Leopold Stokowski leading the Philadelphia Orchestra in Johann Sebastian Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor. This is a recording that goes back to 1927, so it will not sound like a modern recording. What should we listen for in this from your perspective, Paul?
So it's a long time ago, so it's hard to imagine that this was a recording in which Stokowski's ability as a conductor, his power as a showman, and his mastery of the recording process all came together. There'd been 15 years of so-called acoustic recordings, then good microphones were introduced and better ways of arranging things to get better sound, and Stokowski adapted to that. Then he came up with a transcription of a Bach organ work that could take advantage of the fact that he now had technology at his disposal in a double sense, the 100-piece orchestra that he led and not the recording studio in this case because it was recorded at the Academy of Music, but the process of recording. So the showman, the conductor, the transcriber of Bach, and the recording pioneer, all in one man, Stokowski, working together to make this recording.
Let's listen. Leopold Stokowski leading the Philadelphia Orchestra in Johann Sebastian Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, recorded in 1927. Our guest Paul Eli has written a book about the many ways that the music of Johann Sebastian Bach has been transformed and reimagined over the years by composers and musicians and new technology. His book is called Reinventing Bach. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and we have a lot more music to play, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
Phoebe specializes in healthcare, housing, and support services for senior adults. From independent living to rehabilitation services and skilled nursing, Phoebe offers continuing care retirement communities in Lehigh, Berks, Bucks, and Montgomery counties. On November 2nd, Phoebe presents the Institute on Aging Conference, featuring keynote speaker Larry Minix, CEO of Leading Age. The conference focuses on reclaiming advocacy duties to benefit seniors in our communities. Details at phoebe.org. Phoebe Ministries supports WHYY.
You did it. You bought back a half a day during our fall FM membership campaign. I'm Marty Moscoane. This means that for the rest of the day, you won't be hearing live membership breaks. It also means we have a good head start towards achieving the goals of our membership campaign. If you contributed as part of our buyback effort, we thank you very much. If not, we still have a ways to go to reach our overall goal. So please visit WHYY.org right now and make a pledge of support. Thanks.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, The Beginning. Yannick Nézet-Séguin in his inaugural concert as music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Renee Fleming joins Yannick for this gala event. Opening night tickets at 215-893-1999 and at philorg.org. Thursday, October 18th, one performance only at the Kimmel Center. Renee Fleming joined Yannick Naizet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra for their inaugural gala concert.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Paul Eli. He's a faculty fellow at Georgetown University, a longtime editor at Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. In fact, they have published his new book, and it's called Reinventing Bach. And we were just playing the Stokowski version, I should say, of Johann Sebastian Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor. In your book, you include some interesting conversations between Walt Disney and Stokowski about this particular fugue. Can you take us into their conversation?
So Stokowski and Disney, they were similar figures in some ways. They were at the leading edge of their art, but they had a great sense of the public. They were populists. And they got together in Hollywood, and one thing led to another, and they decided to make this movie, Fantasia. Right. And Stokowski had to prevail on Disney to open with the Toccata and Fugue in D minor. People thought it would be too difficult. It's an abstract piece. It doesn't. It wasn't written for orchestra, etc. And Stokowski got his way. So most people who were introduced to classical music by Fantasia were, in effect, introduced to classical music first of all by Johann Sebastian Bach. The visual effects matched to the Toccata and Fugue in D minor as played by Stokowski and the Philadelphians.
Well, and you include some conversation between Disney and Stokowski, and it seems that Disney didn't quite get it, as you said. He didn't quite understand this piece of music.
Right. He's one of those people who liked to have it explained to him, but then he was ready to get it, and he was confident that this was also true of the people who would go to see the movie.
Disney says, so what does the Toccata and Fugue represent? And Stokowski says, it's a motif or a decorative pattern which gradually develops more and more. Finally, it becomes perfectly free. The theme comes at the beginning, develops more and more, the more and more voices and instruments. It's a growth like a tree growing from a seed. It's a beautiful description of this piece of music.
It's fantastic, and you can see, if you know Fantasia, that the animators, they were given these notes from Stokowski, and they really acted on them. They tried to produce, through visual effects, a work that expanded and developed and went to new places and attained perfect freedom.
You also include, and I do want to play a performance of Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Albert Schweitzer on organ, but I think we need to talk a bit about Albert Schweitzer and I guess the role that he plays in the development and the reinvention of Bach. Can you talk about that?
So Schweitzer, who was born in 1875, he was roughly contemporary with Stokowski, left behind his expertise as a Bach organist. And as an amateur theologian, he'd written an important book on the historical Jesus, to become a medical missionary in West Africa. And he thought when he did that he was not going to play the organ anymore. But he got, as a gift, a specially treated organ, one that could survive the moisture of the tropics. So he'd play Bach every night after finishing his work. And one thing led to another, his fame grew. And there was an opportunity for him to raise money for his medical mission by making some Bach organ recordings. So he went into a church in London, and he recorded a lot of Bach organ music, including the Toccata and Fugue in D minor. And I think of him as a missionary for Bach. I tell the story in the book of how this man who knew Bach's organ music really well wanted it to be known to people outside the churches. And suddenly there was the means to do so, recording technology. Mm-hmm. They hung up the microphones in a certain way. He made the recordings, and we're still listening to them years and years later. On Halloween night in Brooklyn, where I live, all the houses, big old houses, are decorated with spider webs and fake cracked glass and so forth. And out from the windows of one of the houses comes the Toccata and Fugue in D minor. And it's in Schweitzer's recording from 1935.
Oh, wow. Well, let's listen again. Albert Schweitzer performing Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, recorded in 1936. Let's listen.
Thank you.
again, Albert Schweitzer performing Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, recorded back in 1935-1936. Interestingly, I mean, Bach was an organist as well, and I wonder if Schweitzer felt a kind of simpatico with Johann Sebastian Bach.
Very much so. As an organist, as a religious person, and also as a person who felt that he was at the end of an age, he wrote a big book on Bach, and in his book, Bach is at the end of a long age of church music. And Schweitzer understood himself to be at the end of a long tradition of the music of capital W Western civilization. Mm-hmm. And what I hear in that recording is the sound of the long past that preceded the age of recordings. All the organ playing from the 1720s or whatever up to the 1930s when the recording's made.
It's interesting to think, and your book in part and tracks the evolution in technology and in recording as well. And as you had said earlier, Bach himself was an inventor. So it sort of makes sense that these new inventions, recording inventions, could carry his music forward. Can you help us understand how this technology developed?
So I'm listening to these records. I'm a devotee of Bach, but not a musicologist. I know the music through recordings. And suddenly as a writer, I realize that I've got an amazing story to tell. And partly it's because these people influence one another. Schweitzer influences Stokowski, and they both influence Pablo Casals, and they all influence Glenn Gould. And then I ask myself, well, how does that influence happen? Right. And it's in large part through recordings. And when I realize that the progress of recording technology tracks with the reinvention of Bach's music, then the story feels like a big, bold story about the times we live in. Because I think you can argue that recording technology is an invention that has as much bearing on the way we live our lives as just about anything, that our experience and our way of encountering the past and the arts comes as much through recording technology as through anything else. So I try to tell that story in the book. We start with 78 RPM records, and suddenly there's a recording studio devised. Then the LP is created. You can distribute longer works and better sound. Then there's this thing called stereo that enables us to hear the sound of the room in a new way. And then headphones, we can have an intimacy with that recording, and we're off and running.
Yeah, and earbuds and all the ways that we can listen to music now.
When I was first getting into the music of Bach, I would listen to a Bach cantata on my way to work every day, walking in Manhattan. And it was about 20 minutes from where I lived to where I worked, and that's about how long a Bach cantata is. And so that struck me, but also it struck me that until about 25 years prior, until the 70s, you really couldn't walk to work listening to a Bach recording. This was an experience that's unique to our time. And I was just knocked out by this experience. And the long history of Bach, we're encountering it in a new way. Now that we have Bach on our phones, it's happening all over again.
And that's Paul Eli, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book, Reinventing Bach. And we're also playing lots of music as well. A show like this invites lots of music. You had mentioned Pablo Casals, and we do want to play an excerpt of a performance he did in 1936, a 1936 recording, Suite Number 2 in D minor. But you include him as an important person to understand as we see this reinvention of Bach. What did he bring to this composer and his music?
Two crucial things to say about Pablo Casals and Bach in this recording. The first is that Casals is credited with supposedly discovering the cello suites. They'd been neglected. They weren't known to even to great cellists like young Casals. He brought them into the body of work that now represents Bach. The second thing is he recognized a certain aptness of the recording studio for the cello suites. For him, they were the music of solitude. But you couldn't be alone with the cello suites prior to recordings unless you were the cellist, unless you were a king who could hire a cellist. Suddenly, he can go into what was then a state-of-the-art recording studio, Abbey Road Studios, brand new, and make a recording that transmits this solitude or this intimacy into the middle-class living room. And when he can do that, he can capture the cello suites for thousands of people in a way that hasn't been heard before.
He says, I believe I got this correctly, that it took him decades before he could play or would play Bach in public.
That's right. The cello suites he didn't play in public for decades. And you ask yourself, well, He's a virtuoso. This is his favorite piece. He plays it every day. Why isn't he playing it in public? And the best answer I could come up with, and I try to dramatize this by telling his whole story in the book, is that for him, they were the music of solitude. They were in some ways diminished by an audience or a concert hall, and the proper place for them was the recording studio. So he had a chance in 1936 to go into Abbey Road Studios and make a recording, and he grabbed it.
And this is Pablo Casals, an excerpt of Pablo Casals performing Suite No. 2 in D minor from that 1936 recording. Excerpt of Pablo Casals performing Suite No. 2 in D minor from a 1936 recording and composed by Johann Sebastian Bach. Paul Eli, you write in your book on a chapter on Casals. He says, "For the past 80 years, I've started each day in the same manner. I go to the piano and I play two preludes and fugues of Bach. I cannot think of doing otherwise. It's a sort of benediction on the house." Beautiful, moving words.
Amazing to think that for 80 years he would play Bach every morning. He said that the housekeeper at his mansion knew the tunes because she was so used to hearing them every morning. And then to hear the recording that he made at Abbey Road, the strange thing about Abbey Road Studios, and I try to bring the strangeness across in a dramatic fashion in the book, is that it's a studio that's in a big house in St. John's Wood in London. So Casals has made music of Bach, the music of the modern house. He played it every day for 80 years as a benediction on his own house, and then he goes into this specially prepared house that is Abbey Road Studios and makes a record that can then make it house music for the bedsits in middle-class parlors of England and America and Europe.
And just to connect these two, Abbey Road, of course, is where the Beatles recorded a lot of their music, or probably most of their music, although, as you were telling me while we were listening to Pablo Casals, probably or in another room at Abbey Road, yes?
There are three studios, and he used the small room, they used the medium-sized room, mm-hmm. and the orchestras used the largest of the rooms. But it's all one place, and the fact that these two extraordinary recordings, the one you just played and the one that you're about to play, were made in the same patch of ground in London, it's amazing to me.
Well, and there's some Bach influence here. We're going to play Beatles' In My Life from their 1965 album. This is Rubber Soul. Since we're talking about Johann Sebastian Bach, how does this fit in, Paul?
Well, as I'm writing this book and learning more about Bach, suddenly I realize that the argument I'm making is really turning out to be more true than I'd imagined. Bach really is everywhere. I'm reading a book about the Beatles, and it turns out that John Lennon, during the Rubber Soul sessions, said to George Martin, their producer, in the middle of the recording of In My Life, "Look, for the middle of this, can you come up with something like Bach on piano?" And they went out for a smoke or whatever outside the studio, and Martin, who was a decent amateur pianist, worked up a kind of Baroque-sounding piano figure, and he recorded it very slowly, and he was a producer. He knew the mechanics of these things. He knew how to speed it up so that at double speed, if the tape was run twice as fast, it would come out at the right tempo and in the right key. And that's what he did, and this is the middle section of In My Life.
And it sounds like a harpsichord.
That's right. And that's what a brilliant improvisation by this producer to be able to work with his skills, the needs of the song, and the technology to get just a harpsichord touch to this recording.
Let's listen. Paul Eli and I were just saying that song never gets old. There's something about just the harmonies and the way that they're playing.
The fact that Bach figures into the song must be part of that. That the Beatles were pushing things forward musically, but they knew well enough to take one of their best songs and add just a Baroque touch that would make it sound current 40 years later.
You're not a musicologist, per se. I mean, you really come at this from your passion for Bach, clearly.
That's right. I grew up playing saxophone and electric guitar, and I have a bunch of instruments in my house and a piano. And I know a fair amount about music, but most of the writing about classical music is written by specialists and probably for specialists. And those are amazing books in their way, but our experience as listeners is not often represented in those books. And for me, it's been tremendously exciting to put the pieces of the story together as a listener for other listeners and try to tell it in one go so that you can just sit down and read it.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Paul Eli about Bach. And his new book is called Reinventing Bach. And it's the story of Johann Sebastian Bach and also how the work of Bach has been transformed and reimagined over the years by composers, musicians, and new technology. More conversation and more music after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Arden Theatre Company, presenting the winner of the 2010 Pulitzer for Drama and Tony Award-winning Next to Normal, now on stage through November 4th. This electric and emotional musical follows one family's struggle to maintain connection amidst crisis. Set to a contemporary score, Next to Normal's bold storytelling expands the scope of subject matter for musicals. For tickets, 215-922-1122 or normalinphilly.com.
I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is a 30-second membership spot and not a live membership break because of you. You pledged before the October FM campaign so that you could hear more news, information, and interviews and less membership messages. That's because you enjoy the programs we present every day on WHYY. If you contributed as part of our buyback effort, thank you very much. If not, please visit WHYY.org right now and make a pledge of support. Thanks very much.
Supporting WHYY, Germantown Friends School, committed to providing academic excellence and Quaker values for boys and girls grades kindergarten through 12, hosting an open house on Saturday, October 13th at 1 p.m. To meet faculty, learn about art, drama, music, and athletics programs, and tour the 7-acre historic urban campus, including the Green Science Center. Germantown Friends School open house this Saturday, October 13th at 1 p.m. GermantownFriends.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Paul Eli. Back in 2003, he wrote a book called The Life You Save May Be Your Own. His new book is called Reinventing Bach, and he's a faculty fellow at Georgetown University, a longtime editor at Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Well, now we are at Whiter Shade of Pale by the British band Procol Harum, and I'm having flashbacks even just anticipating this song, which seems very Bach-like. I mean, obviously, they drew from Bach for this.
It was an amazing time for the recording of Bach. Schweitzer had just died. Casals was still working. Stokowski was still working. Glenn Gould was making some amazing Bach records. There were violinists in Israel and big orchestras in Germany really reconciling after the war over the music of Bach. The music was everywhere. And one of the keyboardists for Procol Harum sat down at the piano and was noodling around on the air and the G string. It's usually done by strings, but he was doing something like that on piano, as he later told it, and that led him to the song that's the signature song for that group.
And it's from 1967, A Whiter Shade of Pale. That's the 1967 single hit by the British band Procol Harum, written by organist Matthew Fisher and bandmates Keith Reed and Gary Brooker. And Paul Eli and I were listening and enjoying that, and you said an interesting thing. If Bach had lived, he'd want some money for all these good recordings, right?
Right. This is out of copyright, but someone from Bach's company would come after Procol Harum and say, you sampled my work without my permission.
Exactly.
Pay up.
It is interesting, though, to listen to this music, and I know that's how you approach it, as something to be listened to. Obviously, you can go to a concert and see it performed, or go to YouTube or even, you know, TV specials and things and see it performed, but there's something about listening.
It's true. I love live music, and certainly the presence of YouTube enables writers now to get back to the sources and cultural history in a way that wasn't possible even 10 years ago. And yet, when you listen to the music, there's something that's actually gained through the deprivation of the other senses. Mm-hmm. When I hear that song, I hear something like the 60s. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, but then when I go to look at it on YouTube and see the costumes these guys are wearing, I think, wow, it really was a long time ago. There's a, if not a timeless, a time-transcending quality about the recording that's not possible when video is added in.
Well, we do want to play some more music, and this is a two-part Invention in F Major performed by the Grammy Award-winning Wendy Carlos on the Moog synthesizer. And talk about technology. It seems like the synthesizer fell in love with Johann Sebastian Bach.
So the first synthesized Bach by Walter Carlos was an incredible labor of love on Carlos's part. You couldn't play more than one key at a time on the early Moog synthesizer, so anything that involved polyphony had to be overdubbed. It took Carlos months to do it. Then the record winds up at Columbia Records. It comes out. There's a pretty good initial push. Carlos winds up on the Today Show. becomes a million-selling record, and Glenn Gould says it's the record of the decade because it fulfills all his expectations for the prospects of recording and what can be done with Bach in new media.
Let's listen. That's a great ending. Two-part Invention in F Major, performed by Grammy Award-winning Wendy Carlos on the Moog. I'm a little frazzled listening to that, but it's fantastic.
I'm struck by how warm it is. We think of synthesizers and electronic music as cold, but the warmth of those early synthesizers, that's what bands like Radiohead are trying to get back to now, the warmth of early electronic stuff. The other thing that I find strange about this recording, and I try to tell the story by fitting this recording in with lots of other things that were going on in the 60s. The synthesizer was new at the time. It's usually thought that, well, we'll use synthesizer to popularize Bach, but really they used the music of Bach to popularize the synthesizer. Here's what this machine can do. It can play the music of Bach. Wow.
It is interesting to think about all this technology and how it allows us to listen to Bach on earbuds, but it's also interesting that vinyl records are coming back, and I think for the aficionado, they want to hear that sort of warm, non-technical sound.
That's right. There's all sorts of discussion about the warmth of vinyl and the spaciousness of it. Someone like Neil Young is an advocate for vinyl and thinks digital has ruined real music. I'm an agnostic on this. What I'm interested in, and the story of the book, is the story of how technology has been generative, how all these different media have called forth new performances of Bach. And the record companies commissioned lots of recordings that we now have forever. Then the CD came out, and they commissioned all new batches of recordings, right. And we have lots more Bach because of that. The emerging technologies have stimulated much more Bach than we could have imagined.
And as you say, you get to walk to work with listening to Bach in your earbuds.
And you don't really have to decide. Right. It's good to hear Bach in a certain way walking on the street with the ambient noise of taxis and traffic there. And it's good another way to be in a perfect small church and hear an ensemble of a dozen people playing on period instruments, doing it more or less the way they think Bach would have done it back in 1720.
And that's Paul Eli, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book called, very simply, Reinventing Bach. We do want to play, and this is Keith Jarrett. It's a harpsichord interpretation of Bach's Goldberg Variations aria from his 2000 album of the same name. What should we listen for in this?
So Keith Jarrett's known as one of the great living improvisers on piano, half-hour improvised works that are then released as double albums by ECM. But when it comes to Bach, and this is what really knocked me out hearing him describe it in a radio interview, he says, Bach doesn't need my help. The music is so marvelous that he tries not to embroider it. He's in the anti-Glenn Gould in that respect. Gould was a very subjective interpreter of Bach, trying to come up with unusual ways to play it. And Jarrett says, no, I'm going to leave the music alone. And for an improviser of his caliber to move so far in the other direction just suggests just how powerful Bach's effect is on a great musician.
Let's listen.
Thank you.
And that's Keith Jarrett's harpsichord interpretation of Bach's Goldberg Variations aria from his 2000 album of the same name. And I'm wondering, Paul Eli, just even listening to that, and obviously Keith Jarrett, as you said, wanting to do, to pay homage to Johann Sebastian Bach, do you wish you had a recording of Johann Sebastian Bach playing his music?
It's hard even to imagine. I saw the harpsichord that's said to be his in a museum in Berlin, and it doesn't have any strings on it. I was then forced to try to imagine what it would sound like. I'm very comfortable with Bach's music being mediated to us by these musicians. The Let a Thousand Flowers Bloom, we've got so many different interpretations. We have no need to go back to the source and hope for one original way.
We have some more music, and this is Bach's Cantata number 82, and I'm going to probably butcher the name, but I'll say it anyway, Ich habe genug, and it's sung by the late Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, and this is a recording, Lieberson, and a recording released in 2003. Let's listen. That's Lorraine Hunt Lieberson and Paul Eli. That's such a moving performance, and there's special reasons why. Can you talk a bit about that?
Lorraine Hunt Lieberson had one of the most unusual careers of any singer. She didn't train as a singer. She was a professional viola player in the Bay Area when it was pointed out to her that she had a remarkable voice. She wound up singing Bach cantatas at Emmanuel Church in, I think, Back Bay, Boston. That church has a cycle of Bach cantatas. They matched them to the right Sundays and feast days. So there was this feast of the music of Bach going on. She became celebrated as a singer of Bach, and this was one of her signature pieces from early on, Ich habe genug. It's a biblical piece from the New Testament. An old man has heard about the birth of the Christ child and says, well, it is enough. I have enough. I've seen my salvation. I can accept. I'm ready to die. But by the time she made this recording, as I understand it, she herself had been diagnosed with cancer, and she had a sense that her own death was near. And that infuses this recording with a remarkable deep feeling. It's hard to know how much it comes from her and how much comes from us and our knowledge of the story.
Yeah.
But that's where the adventure begins. And in telling a story like this, you try to allow for the fact that we're not listening to the recordings outside of the stories of the performers. We're entranced by those stories. And Lorraine Hunt's is a particularly entrancing story.
And we're almost out of time here. You mentioned the 60s as a time for Bach. Are we also living in a time for Bach as well?
It's just unbelievable to me. I think the Bach is everywhere right now, in the concert hall, on our phones, in recordings, represented in the sopranos and media like that. Everywhere I turn, I hear the music of Bach.
Well, on that note, Paul Eli, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's been a pleasure to hear these recordings and speak with you.
Thanks so much. And Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're going to close things out with Glenn Gould, a 1981 recording of Box Goldberg Variations No. 2.